Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Peace Corps is now in its 60th year serving populations around the world, teaching English, developing community assets, building sustainable environmental and agricultural practices, and community health in 60 countries around the world. Today we hear from two volunteers who were in the Peace Corps during very different phases of their life. Randy Hobler was a Peace Corps volunteer in Libya in 1968 and 1969, right after graduating from Princeton University. In fact, his second year was cut short by the revolution that brought Muammar Gaddafi to power in the country. He's written a book about his experiences and that of other Libyan volunteers during the 4 years the Peace Corps actually operated in Libya. His book is 101 Arabian Nights, How We All Persevered in Peace Corps Libya. He's joined by former Tulsan Beth Beeson. She volunteered after she retired from her career in wealth management. She served in China from 2005 to 2007. Today, they reflect on their time in the Peace Corps as the agency celebrates its 60th anniversary. Randy Hobler and Beth Beeson are my guests today on Studio Tulsa. Randy and Beth, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Both of you went to countries that I don't think of as being the traditional places a Peace Corps volunteer would go. Libya, obviously, because for most of the Peace Corps' existence, it was ruled by Gaddafi, and it's been, and even since then, it's been a very unstable country. China, I don't really think of the Peace Corps going there because we think of them now as a competitor, a global competitor, and an antagonistic relationship until the 1980s. So Randy, let me start with you. Why was Libya a place that the Peace Corps went to? And I guess it only was there for a few years.
Sure. There's a big historical overlay on this, but there was a king at the time. It was a kingdom, and the kingdom started in 1951 after World War II. And they only had like three people in the kingdom by 1951 who had ever been, even to university. So you fast forward to 1966 when the Peace Corps started there, and there were these overtures from the U.S. To get there, and you know there was people from the State Department and others that, it worked. It was a two-way thing because the king wanted the people of Libya to be educated, and they particularly wanted them to learn English because they wanted them to learn English and go to university abroad in the UK and in the US. And so by going back and forth there, they finally reached an agreement, and the first group went to Libya in 1966, and it worked very well. There were only 13 people there, and then they upped it to several hundred with us, and it went on from there.
Now, Beth, the same, China was welcoming the Peace Corps?
We were the 11th group that went into China. We were China 11 in 2005. And I always felt like we were a necessary evil, according to their government. They wanted desperately for their kids, their professors, their students, to participate in the economic worldwide stage. And really, we were the best source for them to accomplish that. But while we were there, of course, there were instances where we didn't get our emails for weeks on end. And, you know, they observed everything. They listened to our phone calls. They were very skeptical about all of us. So while they wanted us there, they really didn't like it that much. So it was a double-edged sword.
So you're talking a surveillance regime,
yes,
basically.
Yes, definitely.
I mean, now it's a very sophisticated surveillance regime, mm-hmm. But it was probably done more through manpower and, human power surveillance.
Right. And when I left, you know, the Chinese students were very adept at going around firewalls. They knew exactly which route to take, and so they did that for me so I could communicate with my family back in the U.S. And then for a while, many of my students communicated with me in that manner. And then after about 6 months, they couldn't get through.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this brings up another point that is pretty common to a lot of Peace Corps volunteers, is that Peace Corps volunteers are routinely suspected of being spies. Randy, did that ever happen to you?
Yeah, well, and I should point out that in my book, I interviewed 101 of my fellow volunteers. I'm able to speak for them, as well as I've read 42 books about the Peace Corps. And so it's universal that all over the world, that was an accusation. And the funny thing was, in my village, I had put up, I had a shortwave radio, and I put some wires on the top of my roof so I could get, you know, good reception. And they figured I was a CIA spy for that. And they even hired a local guy to move in right next to me to spy upon me. And it backfired because this guy turned out to be my best friend. But the funny thing is, and I didn't figure it out until, you know, after 50 years kind of thinking it through, but I was always wondering why they were spying on me. And it's a reverse thing. It's like, if you are spying there, therefore there must be something there worth spying upon. But there's nothing there. There's no military base. There's no institute. There's no running water. There's no electricity. There's nothing, you know. So it was a point of pride for them to be spied upon.
Now, I think in your book, you quote one of your colleagues who said, "What would I be spying on? There's no military base for hundreds of miles. There's no government installations. There's nothing here but a small village. What would I possibly spy upon?"
Right.
Yeah. Same for you, Beth?
You know, the students were 18 to 22 years of age, and they all came from villages. So I would say they actually had the maturity level more of like a 14 or 15-year-old. So their mind was not in that place at all. They were the first in their families to ever go to college. They were focused on learning. They didn't really, well, I would say they took as part of their normal life the fact that their government intercepted communications and wouldn't allow them on certain websites. So, they were trained, mentally trained.
What about the community you were in, though?
Well, I lived on campus in faculty housing, and I did teach a class every week to the professors, the English professors. They were much more worldly. Many of them had studied in the United States, and so they were very cognizant of what their government was doing, and they had no control over it, so they didn't really address it.
Yeah. Now, both of you were basically teaching English, which I assume is a major activity of the Peace Corps. And when I think people who have not been in the Peace Corps think about the Peace Corps, they think of community development projects and things like that. But English is a major, teaching English is one of the major routes of the Peace Corps. So both of you did that, correct?
Yes.
Yep.
Did you join the Peace Corps thinking, okay, maybe I will be doing building wells, building access to clean water, or a thing like that? Or did you know, no, I'm going to be teaching English?
I knew I would be teaching English in a university setting for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was going to get into until we went to training. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about training. Randy, how prepared were you to be dropped into Libya and to teach young people English?
It was kind of a mixed bag. There were some things that were excellent that they trained us on, and some things they faltered on enormously. It was often a kind of a DIY for us to try to figure out things and, you know, learn Arabic and things like that that they weren't teaching us sufficiently. So we did manage to get a fair amount of Arabic in place, and they have this this ranking in the Foreign Service of 1 to 5 of how good you are in language, and we got to a level 2 after we did our training. So we at least we were prepared for the Arabic. And the interesting thing about Arabic is when you speak Arabic, it's not like any other country when you're speaking their foreign language where they appreciate it, because everybody appreciates it when you speak a foreign language. But we were speaking Arabic, and to every Arab, Arabic is the language of God. And so this must be Allah. It's the language of Allah. So it was a double kind of compliment for them.
Mm. And Beth, for you?
Well, these kids knew that Mandarin was not the universal language, which made them thirsty and hungry for English. So many of them really were counting on their English skills in order to get jobs, especially in the tourism industry, which was definitely increasing in leaps and bounds in China during those years. So they didn't really want me to speak Mandarin to them at all. In fact, they would often stop me and said, "Would you please speak English? I want my English skills to improve." And so it was a different mindset.
Tell us about where you were actually stationed.
Well, first of all, I trained for 2 months in Chengdu, Sichuan province, mm-hmm. Which borders Tibet on the west. And we were only sent to 4 different provinces, if I remember correctly. And I was sent to a very southern, second and most impoverished province in China called Guizhou province. And I was based in the capital city of Guiyang. And I was stationed, me and one other person were stationed at the traditional Chinese medical college there. And there are only 3 of those in the entire country. And so, you know, the kids who came to that university were very excited to be there. It was quite an honor for them to be accepted to the TCM program. My students also studied herbology, acupuncture, a variety of topics where they were majoring in those topics, and they were going to be certified after they graduated.
Mm-hmm. And not only were you teaching the students, you were also teaching the faculty as well.
That's correct. I was teaching the English professors.
Now, Randy, where were you stationed in Libya?
I was 85 miles south of Tripoli in the mountains, the Nafusa Mountains, and there was no running water or electricity, and the people there were bilingual in both Berber, which was a major, you know, tribe area of Libya, and Arabic. And that was, you know, a very, it's totally different, alien culture. I mean, there was nothing in common with anything European in this place. It was like living 1,000 years ago. There were just camels running around and sheep, and, you know, you could have been 2,000 years ago.
And I assume you're going to a market for daily subsistence.
Yeah, and it was kind of weird because no running water and electricity. You'd go down to the local butcher shop, and it'd be filled with flies, and there'd be flies all over the meat. And so you'd say, "You want a cut of this?" And you'd point at it, and they'd slice it off, and they'd sort of wipe off the flies and give it to me. And then I'd bring it home and boil it to death.
Now I've always heard that from a lot of Peace Corps volunteers is just the culture shock of being thrown into a community in which you have just a smattering of the language, just enough to maybe get by or perhaps even get into trouble, and that those first couple of months is just like a deep culture shock. Was it that way for you, Randy?
It was like a bell-shaped curve for our group. Those in our group who had never been overseas kind of got shocked. I mean, I'd been to Europe and places like that, and some of us had. You know, just having lived through, like sometimes you get culture shock, you don't even know you have culture shock. It's only after the fact that you learn about it. But I recognized what that feeling was. And at the same time, I was feeling amazed and kind of strange, but I could cope with it because I'd been through that before. But a couple of us, you know, freaked out and left the Libya in the middle of it after a few months. But most people, you know, carried through.
And Beth, for you, can you talk about that feeling of, I mean, you're obviously in a campus setting, so it might have been a little slightly different. But
well, when we were in training, we were on a campus, and yeah, we were sent out. We had 2 hours of language training first thing in the morning, then we had 2 more hours of cultural awareness training, like where we learned not to talk about Tiananmen Square and that sort of thing. And then we were sent out into the city with an assignment, you know, go buy this, and this, and, you know, make the change and do all that. So we got to practice it. But that was 2 months' worth of exposure that was kind of gradually integrated into our lives. We were living with host families at that time. And but after that training period was when the rubber hit the road. We were sent out into some pretty remote areas, but mine was a city at 3 million. And they talked about how small it was. And I remember thinking, small compared to what? Oh, well, Chongqing, 15 million. There you have it. So it was an adjustment more coming out of training, moving into my site, my permanent site, than any other time. But there we did have our faculty, friends, and You know, they were wonderful. They were just so happy to see us, and we spent lots of time with them socially. And I played on a badminton team and all kinds of fun things like that, that I really feel lucky to have gotten to socialize with these people. They were very interesting people.
One of the things you told me about before we began was this is, you know, I was not sure whether I was doing it for my students or whether I was doing it for me.
Yeah, my students insisted on speaking English with me. I mean, they would literally scream out my name across campus and run across the yard to walk with me so they could practice English. That's how much they wanted it. They were hungry for it because for them it was a ticket to a better economic existence, and for their families too. There were two families I got to meet in their villages because of my students. On a Saturday morning, we took the bus back to their village, and I saw the poverty in which they'd grown up. It was incredible.
Yeah.
Very alarming, actually.
Yeah. Randy, did you have the same sort of experience with your students? Or since this was sort of a government mandate that they learn English, did they have that same sort of interest in learning English?
They were inherently interested. And also, we were trained by a guy named John Rasias, who was this amazing Zorba-like Dartmouth professor who trained Peace Corps people all over the world. And he was just amazingly inspiring to make the training very entertaining. And so I was able to do that, and I talk about this in the book, and convey that sense of excitement about the language through the training that we got. And so they never had a problem. I had two schools, though. I mean, it's so funny that I trained in. One school, the kids were always unruly and a problem. And the other, they were always very nice and sweet. So it was a very strange thing. I mean, they all loved to learn the language, but some of them were very, very unruly.
My guest today is Randy Hobler. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in Libya from 1968 to 1969. He's been an international marketing consultant and worked in a number of fields since then. Beth Beeson, who is a graduate of the University of Tulsa, lives in Coffeyville, was a Peace Corps volunteer in China from 2005 to 2007. She worked in wealth management, and she actually went to the Peace Corps after her first career. And we're talking about the Peace Corps on its 60th anniversary. Randy has written a book about his time in the Peace Corps called 101 Arabian Tales, How We All Persevered in Peace Corps Libya. They're both my guests today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things I know from Peace Corps volunteers that I hear regularly is the fact that you make these incredible relationships, not only with your class of fellow volunteers, but also with some of the people that you are involved in their community. Have those relationships lasted? Randy, do you have lasting relationships from your Libyan time?
Well, the first thing, or broader thing I would say, is the bonding that took place was incredible, both between the Peace Corps volunteers and in the communities. I mean, the people were so hospitable there, and all over Libya, we just made these very deep relationships. Because of the lack of communication in Libya over the last 50 years, there's been very little electricity or email or that kind of thing. So we haven't had a chance to reach back except selectively to folks in our villages.
No. And Beth, for you?
Well, as I mentioned, the government actually blocked communication. All of us who had left China attempted to stay in touch with our favorite students, usually we'd say. But after about 6 months, we couldn't reach them. And still, to this day, I can't. Mm. However, the connection among the actual volunteers is very strong. And
really?
Probably be until the day we die, because it was such an immersion into a very strange experience. And you just reach out to the people sitting next to you, you know. It was wonderful.
And Randy, you were going to say something.
Oh, I was just saying, to piggyback on what Beth and you had said, is there was one case where when the Gaddafi revolution hit, this one volunteer gave his student a copy of the U.S. Constitution. And at that point in time when Gaddafi took over, English was prohibited. So he hid this thing and he used it to learn English. And later he went to the University of Kalamazoo and became a U.S. citizen and then became like the fourth most famous, you know, vintner in the world. So it was a great story for what had happened from that.
That's amazing. Now, both of you were at interesting times. Randy, you were in Libya in 68 and 69. I guess the Libyan revolution, the Muammar Gaddafi revolution, was that 1971?
No, 1969.
1969. So you right at the end of your time.
We were there, yeah. We went through that.
So give us an idea. Did you have any inklings this was happening?
No, and that's this funny thing. I mean, you go through life and you think, oh, you do this and that, and you can control your life. And a revolution happens. It tosses everything into a hot top hat. And, you know, luckily it was a bloodless revolution because the king had left. And he wanted to get rid of his nephew, and so he was ready to stage a fake revolution on the 2nd of September. And then Gaddafi heard about this revolution, said, "You know what? I'm going to preempt this and start the revolution on September 1st." And so on September 1st, his people started taking over the post office and the radio station and the TV station, all this stuff. And the other people said, "Oh, I guess they moved it all up one day." And so there was bloodless. They were working side by side. So we were lucky that hardly anybody was hurt.
Did that immediately bring your Peace Corps adventure to an end?
It did, except it wasn't immediate because they're a third world country, and they said, "You are all CIA spies. Leave now." And it took them 2 months to get us out of there.
Now, Beth, you were also talking about the fact that you saw enormous changes in 2005 to 2007. What were they like in your part of China?
Well, when we all flew into Chengdu for training, to begin our training, we were met by our host family and transported to our new apartments. And everyone was riding bicycles. I mean, literally. 10 rows of traffic were all riding bicycles. And by the time we left in 2007, the bike lanes were along the side of the road and cars were in the other lanes. It was that fast. Wow. It's just incredible.
And did you notice, I mean, was it a gradual change or you just started seeing cars and you started seeing more cars or was it just like almost overnight?
No, it was gradual.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in my location, my site, it took a little, there was a lag time versus the bigger cities started, you know, having more of a car population earlier than the little remote areas. But yeah. It was a significant shift.
Yeah. Well, my guests today are Randy Hobler, Beth Beeson. Both were Peace Corps volunteers, both at very different times of their life. Now, Randy, you did this right after university.
Right.
You went on to, this was sort of a formative experience in the start of your career. How did the Peace Corps experience affect you and how you moved on with your career after the Peace Corps?
Well, a lot of us, of the 101, maybe 90% of us, it totally changed the trajectory of their career. While it didn't change the trajectory of my career, it just permanently embedded in me all these appreciations, and I'm sure Beth has the same kinds of observations about, what it's like for foreign countries, how certain countries are superior to the United States in various ways that you never were aware of before, the sort of demonization of the Arabs that we saw that was going on that we never were aware of inside our own media bubble in the United States, an appreciation that all people around the world have no quarrel with one another. It's only the leaders that are doing all the mischief. So it gave me a very deep appreciation of those kinds of things that I carry with me. And I try to convey in terms of my civic responsibilities.
And you mentioned, you said it gave you a sense that some countries are superior to the United States in certain areas. What struck you about your time in Libya that struck you in that way?
A couple of things. One is there were certain kinds of food, like couscous, which is the best in the world. The level of hospitality, I'm sure it's the same. I know it's the same in other Arab countries, but the level of hospitality is unbelievable. And it comes from the law of the desert, and this is mentioned by T.E. Lawrence in his book. And the rule is that if you're a Bedouin in the middle of the desert and all you've got is one handful of rice and some guest comes into your tent, you have to give them that little you have remaining. And that's just embedded deeply into their psyche, into their DNA. And to appreciate, to experience that is very, very touching and very amazing.
And Beth, you came to the Peace Corps at a very different point of your life. You'd already had a career. You'd retired at age almost 50, and then you said, I'm going to go into the Peace Corps. So how did that affect the trajectory of your life after coming back from China?
Well, I had already lived in two other countries prior to going to Peace Corps, so I just had a craving for other cultures. My grandmother was French, so I was exposed to a lot of different foods and art and a lot of things that were not normal in a normal American household. So I was very ready for something way off the chart, not just European, because I'd lived in Switzerland and The Hague. So China fit that bill, but I was very motivated because of my sister adopting a baby girl from China. And also, having been in the investment arena, I was real aware of China's power, economic power, and I wanted just to learn more about it firsthand. So once I got to China, I found myself real intrigued with how intrigued the Chinese kids were about America. I mean, one course was spoken English and the other was American culture. And American culture was by far the most fascinating for me and for my students. They loved the entertainment industry. They loved all the singers. You know, the kids would give themselves names, like a guy gave himself the name Beyonce. I said, well, you know she's a girl. He goes, I know. So it was just fascinating for me to see how far-reaching our culture had been, and particularly the movies, the singers, the dancers, all of the entertainment industry, sports. I mean, you know, it was fascinating for me. Mm. So they were primed for that type of curriculum.
Mm. One other comment on that is I'm sitting in this village as described, and they were at the poverty level, and they had no idea they were poor.
Yeah.
They were just perfectly happy. They had enough to eat, you know. They had bread and camels and goats and vegetables and things, and they had no idea that they were poor. I mean, they're just perfectly happy.
Well, it sounds like it was a great experience for both of you. Randy shares his experience and those of other Peace Corps volunteers in this short window that the Peace Corps was in Libya for about 1966 through 1969. And his book, 101 Arabian Tales. And Beth, thanks you for coming in and sharing your stories from China in the early 2000s. Randy and Beth, thanks very much both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peace Corps volunteers Randy Hobler and Beth Beeson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa on the 60th anniversary of the Peace Corps. Randy Hobler has written a book about his experience and other Peace Corps volunteers that served in Libya for a short 4 years, 101 Arabian Tales, How We All Persevered in Peace Corps Libya. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.